Geek Speak for March 30, 2013.
It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. In the second half of today's show, we'll be taking calls with questions and comments about technology. So if anything piques your interest and you want to ask us, please feel free to call us. 1-800-655-5877. That'll probably be in the second half. And I'll give out that information again right before I invite the calls in. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe. Hi, Ben.
Yo. Haven't seen you in a while, right?
A web instructor and world traveler and couch surfer to some degree, because last night you were crashing on my couch. It was awesome.
Yeah, that's true.
And literally, we had a bed and everything, but you liked the couch.
Yeah, I don't know. Just familiar.
Yeah. But last night we got in this whole music thing. I guess, by the way, we're starting with music.
Yeah, okay. we'll start with music.
So last night we got in this whole thing about music, because I can't remember why I asked you, but I made three notes. You know, to kind of say, and
yeah,
you
like,
kind of know
ba,
it would be,
ba.
Yeah. What were they?
Ba, 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 ba,
probably,
I think.
Yeah, okay. And I said, so what would be the, so as a music person, you kind of know what fits in that. And you looked at me like, and then go into a 2-hour conversation about music. Because I guess what I had done, what you described to me last night was that I implied a tension that would be resolved with a chord with a tritone, which would then add a tension that would then again resolved as well to a 4-chord. Is that about
kind
what?
Of, yeah, the three notes that you sang to me implied a chord which had to resolve to another chord, which had to resolve to another chord. So it was like a tension on top of a tension.
So I asked for like a conclusion of one note, and you're like, oh,
of
no,
all the
chord
notes
progression.
To sing.
And you said, like, really, you took it took a beat, and then you said, that is probably the most it's most uncomfortable tension thing I've ever heard you say. Something like that.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah,
so we have a piano. We rolled it into the other room. Will you, yeah. Will you jump on the piano? We can talk a little bit about music.
Yeah, you get the other mics.
Okay, I got all the mics on. I'm trying
right,
to figure
cool.
this all out. All right.
See if this works. So, yeah, I really like this piano, and I always want to play it because it's got this kind of old feel to it. But there's always someone in the air room doing some kind of radio thing. I don't know. Is this a radio station or something? So it's kind of fun to be able to play it. But yeah, so.
Okay, so let's start with a chord. Just the 12 notes. Everybody knows not a chord. Eight.
So those are our 13 notes or 12 notes in the scale, right?
Okay. So, the 12 notes in the scale. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So that was that C?
That's a C, right? So if that's our root, we're opening up the piano now. Moving microphones.
Oh, I know. It's horrible sounds.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, everyone
squeaky.
In radio land.
All right. So yeah. So here's what I was talking to you about last night, right? So if you just start with an octave, right? So you have this note, you have that note.
12 notes higher.
And they're the same note, basically, right? One is higher than the other, but if you look at it acoustically, they're the same note, just it's a doubled frequency.
Frequency
right?
Doubling, yeah.
So the cool thing about the scale is, or at least Western scale, is you have 12 notes. You have 1, 2, 3, 4. There's our 12th note, and then we're back to 1 again, right?
Yeah, and you were saying something about 12 being important.
12 is kind of a magic number. Right? Like 24 is a magic number and 32 is a magic number.
3 was the magic number. But okay.
As a math geek, I really like numbers that divide nicely. Right? And so 12 divides really nicely. You can cut it in half and get 6. You can cut it in 3 and you get 4. And you can cut it in quarters and you get 3. And so you can kind of apply this to music, actually. Like you can take those 12 notes and you can cut them in half and you get this note. So that's the note right in between. And that's
okay,
called
and that's
a tritone. That's one of the things that was implied by what you sang was a tritone. And I'll talk about tritones in a sec because they're really neat. But if you cut them in, if you cut the scale in 3, you get an augmented chord, which is what's that song by the Beatles? Oh, darling, that song.
Yeah.
So that starts with a augmented. If you cut it in 4, then you get this diminished 7 chord. So
this is all taking this 12 same 12 notes and deciding to play the The third, which is the middle and the two ends, if you will, and then the augmented, which is basically cutting it in thirds. So you used to go every third note.
Not quite every third, but if you cut it in quarters, you get the diminished. That's every third note. Because
four times three
is 12.
And
if you do it the other way
around,
it's
every fourth note, you get three notes. Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right, and tritone, you get two notes. Right.
All right. So you were talking about symmetry and tritones, and I finally got that after a while.
Yeah, but you know what's so interesting is I've been into math my whole life, and I've been into music my whole life, and I didn't connect this until very recently, is that you've got these 12 notes in a chromatic scale, and you can divide them in these ways and get these different chords. And incidentally, these three things, the tritone, the augmented, and the diminished, they sound weird. They sound uncomfortable, right? We're used to hearing a nice, pretty...
And now you're playing a chord that we... a major chord.
Yeah, they're nice, pretty major chords, mm-hmm. and they have certain characteristics. Like, they have four half tones or four half steps on the bottom and three half steps on the top as far as the separation of the notes.
Which
so
sounds right to us.
It's kind of a bottom-heavy, nice grounding. Uh-huh. Grounding sound, and then a minor chord we're also used to, this kind of sadder tone, like, oh god, I'm forlorn, right? And that's actually top heavy. It's got three half steps at the between the first two notes and four between the second and third notes.
So Ben, we're used to hearing, I love these. When you talk this way.
I'm so excited. So these are chords that we're used to hearing, but the ones that I was just playing, like augmented and diminished seven, they sound weird. And coming from a music theory perspective, or coming from someone who's new to music, how do you fit those in, right? They don't really fit in a way, also because they're perfectly symmetrical, mm-hmm. just by either two or three or four. They don't have a bass.
Right.
Right? They don't have a root.
The other thing that's interesting, of course, is that we declare the chord that we're in by the bass note, if you will, the first note. And so in like a C major, it's clearly that C is the bass there, because you actually have different half steps. You have, third half steps and then fourth half steps. So you're actually...
Yeah, four and three,
It structurally has a bass. But in this totally symmetrical type things, where you're dealing with the tritone, the augmented, and the divided, you could really say that any of those are the bass, because there is no definition of differentiation between the notes. So if you just shift it up in the tritone completely halfway, what's the middle note in the tritone?
So C and F sharp, right? F-sharp. So C and F sharp. So
that's just as much an F sharp tritone as it is a C. Is that the right way to say?
Yeah, exactly. That's perfect, because you can do this, and the relationship between these notes is a certain relationship. And then if you go up and you, instead of playing the C at the bottom, you play the C at the top, the relationship between those notes fractionally is exactly the same. And then you could keep going up and go up to those, and that's the same relationship. So it's the same relationship over and over again. You don't have any kind of reference frame because you're dividing the scale perfectly.
Right.
And so you have this rotational symmetry, if you will, right? So from a mathematical perspective.
Right. And so it's almost like the chord base that we give, that hint of what chord we're in with the major seventh, major, for example, it gives us structure to say this is the chord we're in, and then when we switch that, you know there's a chord switch. So if you went from, so go ahead and play.
Yeah, if you go from C to F, you're still going from that to that chord, right?
Yeah.
And it's because you have that reference frame, because of the relationship of the notes implies a certain reference frame, right? So that's kind of cool. One other thing that's really neat about this, aside from the whole,
Well, I'm going to say that Ben's got one more thing really neat about this. Say that. But first, we got to take a little break. Is that cool?
Because
I think it's a great discussion, and I want to get back to the music. And then, of course, we'll get back, of course, into geek news as well. But stay tuned.
Talks from the legendary TED stage are coming to radio.
What TED celebrates is the gift of the human imagination.
Everything we think,
we've had to believe in impossible
infinite possibility.
Big ideas that will change the way you look at the world. I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
TED Radio, Friday night from 7 till 8 on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. KUSP is supported by Cruzio's Velocity Internet and Phone Service. Velocity achieves download speeds of up to 40 megabits per second with nationwide phone service included. More information is at velocity.cruiseio.com or 459-6301. And by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment, crowns and veneers. Information is at RamirezDDS.com.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP's Central Coast Public Radio 88.9.
It's kind of cool. TED has a radio hour. And actually, there are a lot of really good talks about music at TED's website.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
If you feel like doing that. But there was one other cool thing, like the augmented chord, that's this guy here, and the diminished chord, the diminished seventh chord, they sound like chords, right? But the tritone, that doesn't sound like a chord. It's just two notes, and it just sounds kind of weird. In fact, it sounds kind of evil. The Catholic Church, this is probably apocryphal, but the apocryphal story goes that singers were punished for using that interval in their music.
Oh, really?
Which is kind of ridiculous. Good. It's called the Devil's Fourth, right? It's an augmented fourth, and it sounds icky. But what's so cool about that is it's actually the source of a lot of the tension in Western music. So, like, if you hear something like this, that wants to go to...
Right, it's like a conclusion to it.
Wants to resolve.
Right.
Like, it's almost like it's just falling down into the chord that's already destined to fall into,
yeah,
or something.
Awesome.
And the cool thing about that is that when you're playing this chord, the third and the seventh, these two, are a devil's fourth or a tritone, right?
Right.
So that is where all the tension comes from whenever you hear seven chords. And you hear seven chords in pop music all the time, or really any kind of music all the time,
okay,
especially in the Western world.
Let's wrap the music section up with,
absolutely,
just what three notes did I actually play last night, and what did that put in your mind as the conclusion?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the three notes that you sang were like that. I assumed the first note you sang was the root, so...
That would be the chord, the C. Yeah. You're just running it in C. Right.
To me, that implied, which implied it would resolve to, which implied it would resolve to this. So.
So
had this nice tension and resolution,
so,
and this is all within
so
my
brain. I hum three little notes, and you turn into a full song. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was. Kind of fun.
All right. Well, thanks for geeking out on music. I know that you don't normally do it on Geek Speak, and I really appreciate it, of course, because it's one of those things where you clearly have this ear for it, you have this mind for it, and then it's such perfect radio content in the sense that it sounds beautiful.
Yeah,
so thank you, Ben.
It's not something you have to see. One thing I would suggest, if you're into math, get into music.
Yeah.
If you're into music,
get into math.
Get into math. They are so connected.
All right. We did a whole bunch of oral things, audible things. Let's do some physics stuff. I got any physics,
sure,
stories?
Like I do. Thing? Yeah, I came across this fantastic article about graphene aerogel. So a while back,
okay,
I think we covered a story about this. Maybe we did. We've covered the world's lightest material competition, if you will.
Yeah.
It's not actually a competition, but...
My memory of the aerogel story that we did before was it was like this transparent, fluffy, goopy stuff, which was made up of very fine...
It wasn't goopy.
Not goopy, but fine and fluffy. Like a...
Imagine like a sponge.
Yeah. But really spongy.
Really, really airy, right? So so we had one thing that people have talked about before, just a couple years ago, frozen smoke is what it was dubbed.
Yeah.
And it had a density of 4 mg/cm³. So a cubic centimeter is 4 mg. That's really, really, really lightweight.
Yeah.
That lost its lightest material title, if you will, in 2011. We made a microlattice material which had a density of not 4 mg/cm³, but 0.9 mg. So,
whoa,
cut it in half, or cut it in
even
a quarter,
lighter.
I'm sorry. And then about a year later, we came up with aerographite, which going from 0.9 to 0.18,
whoa,
milligrams per centimeter cubed. So really lightweight.
That, yeah.
So now we have a new title holder. It is a graphene aerogel, and this physics team created it. It has a density of 0.16, and that is lighter than helium.
What?
Per amount of volume.
Whoa.
It's
Does
like
it have
half
vacuum in it or something?
Well, so if I think it's that if you measure it in a vacuum.
Okay.
The material itself is actually lighter. Yeah.
Because once you put it in an environment, unless it's closed cell, it would actually be infused with the gas around it.
Yeah.
So then, for our environment, it's mostly nitrogen, so it'd be heavier than.
Yeah. So if you were to put this in a vacuum,
maybe
it would
you can only make it in a vacuum. Maybe it collapses in a non-vacuum. But this stuff also doesn't look like frozen smoke.
Well,
it looks like frozen soot. It's darker.
It's
not translucent.
Weird ball of black stuff. And you know, the picture that they have is it's sitting on top of some blades of grass or something like that, right? Which is a little bit misleading because you can't, if you weigh it in that environment, then you're going to be weighing the air that's inside of it as well, you know. So but I mean, this is like only twice the weight of hydrogen.
Graphene.
That's ridiculous.
That's amazing.
And actually, I want to bring up something that we did last night with the candles. Do you remember?
Oh yeah, we tried.
Yeah, we tried.
Last night the kids got all into ice and carbon monoxide and frozen ice.
Yeah, we were talking about
stuff.
Dry ice.
Yeah, the kids and you were chatting about that, right?
Yeah. We were talking about carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
And we lit two candles. There's this really cool experiment you can do, but you kind of have to get it just right.
Yeah.
What you do is you get a cup full of carbon dioxide. Now, where do you get a cup full of
carbon dioxide?
I figured
out why we failed, by the way.
What?
But go on.
Okay,
so you get
you're going to have to tell me.
You get a cup full of carbon dioxide. Go
yeah,
on.
And to do that, you can take a candle. Candles burn oxygen, produce CO2, just like we do, right? So you put a lit candle inside of a cup. You put something on top of the cup, and then after some short amount of time, the candle burns up, the fire burns up all the oxygen.
All the oxygen gets bound to the carbon dioxide in the candle, or the carbon in the candle gets carbon dioxide and boom, or carbon dioxide. And you basically get no more oxygen in the candle. Candle goes out.
Okay. The candle goes out on its own, and then you've got this cup full of CO2. CO2 is heavier than air, so if you take off the lid very carefully and there's no wind blowing around or anything, you'll actually have a cup full of CO2. And you won't be able to see the CO2. It just looks like a cup with air inside of it. But it's actually, you've got a cup that's, you know,
what do you
overflowing
do with the cup?
With CO2. And then what you could do is you can pour the cup full of CO2. You can pour the CO2 over another candle, and it'll get rid of all the oxygen around the candle because you're pouring CO2
right.
on it. Kind of like you would douse out a flame
with water, right.
But you're dousing it out with
and
CO2.
And it didn't work with us.
It didn't work.
And the reason is, I think, pretty simple. I think what happened is the candle heated up all the air inside the container mm-hmm. as it burned the oxygen out and transferred the oxygen into carbon dioxide.
The first candle
we lit. But then we lifted the thing off. But all that air in there, all the gas in there was hot. And it rose in the room. So what you need to do is do the same thing, but put ice around the cup so it gets really cold. That way it won't be less, because heated gases expand mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so therefore it might have been, if it was the same temperature as the air around, it would have been denser, but since it wasn't the same temperature because it had been heated up in the little cup mm-hmm. then it floated away. But what we'll do is I'll try that to this afternoon with the kids. I'll let you know.
I'm convinced yes. It was actually something else. I'm convinced that it was the heat from the second candle. When we're trying to pour the CO2 over the second candle, the second candle, it wasn't a teeny candle, it was
right.
actually a sizable candle
right.
and so it was producing a lot of heat, and all the air that with the combustion was getting heated, and then just the normal air was going up. And when we poured the CO2 over it, all the heated air that was moving up pushed the CO2 out of the way.
Okay, and the only thing I would argue is that by the dynamics of that cup with the heated candle, air had to be drawn into it as well for it to rise up. It had a convention current. If we could get that CO2 into that, then it would have still put out the candle. I will test it and play with it and let you all know next week, because of course it's so important. But Ben, first off, I want to ask.
I did this when I was a kid, and
it worked.
But like, we're trying to do it.
I know.
And we're adults.
The kids
that know
just
more
laughed
about
at
science.
Us.
Yeah, they were just like, ha, oh, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. That doesn't really work.
That's not a cup of CO2. What was that?
Okay, so in front of me, what does it look like?
I'll describe it. It looks like a really fat iPhone with no screen.
Yeah, it's like a thick iPhone with no screen. It's a little smaller, actually. Kind of reminds me of a pack of cigarettes or something.
Yeah, it kind of looks like it's
But it has the coloring of an iPhone, right? It's got a silver band and a black plastic.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
All right, so here, I'll give you a hint.
So what is it?
I just extended a USB port from the bottom. It's a rotated.
So there's a USB port coming out of the bottom, and it still looks like an iPhone. And what is it, like a battery case for an iPhone or something?
Be prepared to be amazed.
Are you shaving with it?
Yeah. Okay, so...
What?
So every once in a while on Geek Speak, you know, we've been doing crazy USBs a week for a long time. So I get lots of... I don't want to say spam, but I got a lot of marketing email for my GeekSpeak account, right? Lyle at GeekSpeak gets a lot of, hey, talk about this on the show. And it's almost always not appropriate. And a few publishing companies send me stuff, which is totally appropriate. We cover it on the show.
Yeah.
and game companies, stuff like that. But this time it was a USB shaver, and I thought, oh my gosh, I should ask them to send me one, and then I'll do a crazy USB of the week. Because it's silly. It's a shaver, right? That's the USB thing. But the thing is, I've had it for a week, and I've had it for a while. And when I took it to Paris with me, I use like a safety razor, which is like a traditional shaving system I use. So like the brush, you see in the movies, the cowboy movies, that's what I use. Not mm-hmm. a straight razor, but a safety razor, which is like a standard razor. If you've seen the Doors movie. No, you know what? We won't get into that. Sorry. Let's not get into that.
Miles of cowboy, basically.
But basically, I use a traditional wet shaving system. And so I would never want an electric shaver that was kind of eh. But when you travel a lot, you know, you're in the situation where you need to shave quickly. And so I took this thing with me, and it's actually surprisingly cool. It's surprisingly more useful than I expected.
It looks like an iPhone, though.
That's part of the charm.
So weird.
But the other thing is that the power supply, it's got a battery in it. The power supply is a USB, and I've got my computer with me. So charging, it's no problem. So anyway, it's called the Shave Tech, and I saw it on Amazon and it's too expensive, but it's cool. So I guess if you've got money to burn or you really want to have some kind of geeky object, I wouldn't say it's a bad product. I'd actually say it's kind of a good product.
So does it have a light on it? No. Like a little, does it,
oh,
can it
plug
detect
it in?
Light forms? It kind of looks like
it does nothing
tricorder.
But shave. But okay, the point is, I think if you were to get this, you couldn't use it as your primary shaver. It's a backup. It's like, you know, on the road kind of backup type shaver. Mm-hmm. That's what it's for.
Yeah,
but it's
yeah.
functional. I mean, I shaved this morning at a couple hours ago, and I'm already getting hair off my face with it. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, there's a link on geekspeak.org if you want to check it out. Okay, moving on. That's one item that's kind of a geek bit because you got to kind of see it.
That's just weird.
You have a geek bit too, right?
Oh yeah, I did. Well, are you talking about the eclipse bit, or are you talking about?
I was just talking about the JavaScript thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll talk about that then. JavaScript 1K. Basically, it's a competition. There's only, I don't know, like a day left in the competition. So if you feel like you're crazy JavaScript programmer and you want to try and enter into this, you can if you want. But really, I would suggest that people go to the website and take a look at it. Basically, the competition is write an application with only 1 kilobyte of JavaScript. And that's it. Now, kilobyte of JavaScript, if you were to compare it to, what's 1 kilobyte? If you were to transcribe the show so far, even, you know, not counting all the music, right? If you were to transcribe our words, that would be far, far exceeding 1 kilobyte. Kilobyte is probably, if every word is four
characters.
Letters,
yeah,
and then there's a space between each word or punctuation or something like that, that's 5 characters per word, and that would be, it's 250,000 right. words.
No, 250 words.
250
yeah.
words.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of making, a kilobyte is so small.
Yeah, so JavaScript, of course, programming language, we talk about a lot. It's the most popular script programming language on the planet. It's in every browser and all that. And
yeah.
What these people, and this has been done for years. I saw this really great 1K Perl script years ago, which took Mayan numbers and translated and spit out text based off of, anyway, it was really cool. So this idea is that you hone your skill and everybody submits something kind of cool. It's basically something cool and has to be 1,000 characters or less.
Yeah.
And a character, you know, like a A, B, C, so like that. And in the JavaScript language actually has some structures in there that you have to use, but most things can be really short. But of course, there's a lot of cruft. So in this situation, the person's going to write some code, they're going to generate something. And if you want to see them, it's really cool. Go to geekspeak.org and Ben will have a link.
Yeah, I'm
going to
show you one of them. What is this?
This is it looks like a fully rendered bee floating through space.
Like a 3D.
A 3D plush bee flying on the screen. That is under 1,000.
It's 1,000 or less.
Okay, and the other thing is they can't use any images or anything. So that has to all be generated via CSS. And you can use CSS or not.
It's got a tie as well.
Ah, that's awesome.
And
if you want to
like
show some really cool code, it'll be up at geekspeak.org. Ben's got this awesome story. And this whole thing is called JS1K. Right,
yeah.
JavaScript 1K. Awesome.
They also have JavaScript 5K and JavaScript, or you know, they have different categories. But really, to create something really impressive, all you need is 1K, and that's kind of amazing. I mean, if you think about the word, you can take code, you can take JavaScript code, and you can minify it, right? So that's basically crushing everything down. All of your longer words you store in variables, and you reuse them like that, or something like that. But there are certain things you can't minify. What was the example you were talking about earlier?
Well, the word, a very important word in the language of JavaScript is the word function, which is 8 characters long.
And you can't minify that.
You can't do that, no.
So
you'll be able to in the next version of JavaScript, but no.
Java. So function is
is it 1% word? Yeah, only 1% of your program.
Because it's 8 characters, right? Yeah. 10 characters is 1% of your entire program. So just the word function.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. Yeah, for programmers out there, I'm sure really. And let's go into some more JavaScript stuff since you mentioned the 1K project.
Yeah. What do you got?
A few weeks ago, Miles mentioned ASM.js, which is like this assembly language of JavaScript that Mozilla Foundation, the people that make Firefox, have been pushing. And this week at the game conference, Epic Games, who are the makers of the Unreal Engine, and Mozilla teamed up to show the Unreal Engine 3 running in a web browser, and it is gorgeous. We were talking 3 weeks ago on the show about JSM and about the speed difference. It's almost native code, but it's scripting language. And the way that this library works is you can code in C++, you can compile to an intermediary language, I can't remember what it's called, and then from there you can compile to ASM JavaScript, which is basically a subset of JavaScript that's extremely strict, and then any browser that understands JavaScript, all the browsers, can run it. But Mozilla's beefed up version, if you will, runs it almost at machine speed, which means you can have a full 3D rendering environment in browser with no plugins. And the Mozilla project's code for this is open source, so the other browsers should follow suit because it's going to be awesome.
What kind of speed increases are we talking about?
We're talking about half of native.
Half of... So, like...
It's functionally the same.
What does...
Normally, JavaScript's about... It has been common to be about 100 times slower. So 100...
Huh? You know,
yeah.
So you're going from 100 times slower to half the speed?
Yeah, definitely. Pretty awesome. So anyway, I'm really excited to see that. So we're going to start seeing real-time engine. Now, of course, Mozilla Firefox runs in multiple versions. This is Firefox 22, which is almost released. So we're talking about like any...
It's almost here?
Yeah.
Like it's actually almost here. Wow.
Oh, no. Like it's, you can download it and run it right now.
Because like when we talk about increases like that, like it's increased 50 times the speed. I mean...
You think it's going to be a while from now.
Yeah. We're talking about like, scientists or coders or, you know, it's like, it's a year off. I don't know. Whatever, you know, theory.
So if you want to join the conversation, you can do so right now. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe. And who you don't hear is Rick Philman, who's in the other room waiting to take calls. And you can ask us anything you'd like. You can talk about aerogel or music or JavaScript or shaving gear, I guess.
If you want to talk about shaving.
The phone number to call in with questions or comments about technology is 1-800-655-5877. But I do that so fast, that I should do it again. So again, the phone number to call in to GeekSpeak right now is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 655-5877. I'm not totally sure. I think that's 1-800-655-KUSP on the keypads. Yeah, it is. Cool.
8-7. Wow, that's amazing. So I just instinctively closed my eyes and imagined myself with my really old phone typing in KUSP, and sure enough.
Yeah, our keypads on our phones don't even have the numbers in them anymore.
You know what's terrifying? I realized the other day, I picked up my TI-83 Plus graphing calculator. I've been out of school for many, many years.
I was moving out of my office and I found mine too.
Did you really?
Yes, awesome.
But so I learned to code on the TI-83
Plus.
Yes,
of course.
There was no manual, at least not that I found. And I was just, I don't know. Sorry, my Spanish teacher, but I was sitting in Spanish class writing programs about, you know, like trying to get a good clock and stuff. And I discovered I can actually type really fast still on a TI-83 Plus because I learned during that you know, squishy brain.
See, this is the difference between you and me in our age. You learned to program, and I think it's basic on that, right?
It's TI basic.
Okay.
Yeah.
I learned to on a handheld device in a school classroom. I'm only a year older than you. And
that's not true.
And I learned on a Commodore VIC 20 connected to my television.
Isn't that Commodore type of bird?
Yes. No, it's a Condor.
Oh, that's right.
Commodore. Most people had a 64. I had a VIC 20 connected to a television. And so that's the difference in our age. We both learned, same language, I think. No, I had GoTo. Is that basic? I don't even know.
No, we had GoTo. I had GoTo.
Yeah, it's the same. It was the same language.
Oh, God. Cool. I wrote a chat application. I wrote a chat application between two TI-83 Plus calculators.
How do you network them?
Using a TI graphing cable, GraphLink cable.
No way.
which were really overpriced and only came as long as 6 feet. So, like, why would you chat?
Because you're through... in English class. Did you pass it off to a friend?
No, 6 feet is not long enough to get to the desk in front of you.
Sure it is.
So what I did was I went to Radio Shack and I bought some adapters to convert it to 3.5 millimeter stereo, basically an iPod TRS, jack, right? Uh-huh. A TS. And I converted to that, and then I extended it 75 feet. And then I converted back to
you've outdone me. I got nothing. I'm impressed. You got music up your sleeve and that. That's friggin' cool.
Just never try and make a chat application on a calculator.
Why not? I'm doing it today.
because it is stupidly impossible.
I believe it was impossible.
I can't get it.
Do you have the code still?
I'll bore everyone. No, you know what happened to that calculator?
Should we do it?
The one I have is not my original one. The one that had all of my first coding projects, I left it on a bus on a band trip.
Someone in the Midwest is texting his friend on a bus because of you.
Texting? You can text with
the chat.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
effectively. All right. If you'd like to ask us questions about anything,
If we haven't scared us off
or bored the hell out of you, or if you'd like us to hear Ben play again, you're welcome to give us a call. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's, you know what? It's actually rare that I give the phone numbers out a few times we don't get calls. So, yeah. Pick up a phone and give us a call. You're going to get in pretty much right away. Now, of course, all the phone lines will fill up. 1-800-655-5877. But don't concern yourself. We have let's try that all again.
Don't concern yourself because?
We have more news stories to fill the time. Waiting
good
for
set.
Calls. All right. So what's up in the universe, my friend?
I don't know about the universe, but I'll talk about our solar system.
Okay.
So did you guys, there's only one of you in the room. Did you hear about the solar eclipses?
No. And that's what surprises me. I hadn't heard about them at all.
Yeah. Because no human saw them directly.
Okay.
Because the NASA Solar Dynamics Observatory, which is orbiting the Earth in a nearly geosynchronous orbit, it got a couple of eclipses. So the Solar Dynamics Observatory, simply enough, its name is the Solar Dynamics Observatory. I wonder what it does. It observes the sun for solar dynamics and changes and things like that. So I imagine that the people at the SDO got kind of grumpy because what happened was once or twice a year, I think twice a year, the orbit of the SDO aligns with the orbit of the Earth and blocks the sun. And so the Earth gets in the way of the sun.
Okay.
From the perspective of this satellite.
So it was a solar dynamics observatory to Earth eclipse.
It was an Earth eclipse to our observatory.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Man, I would have loved to see that. So we got pictures. We have pictures of this. We also have pictures of all of the celestial bodies were in perfect alignment because this time we didn't just get an eclipse of the Earth against the sun. We also got one of the moon against the sun. And what's so interesting about these two pictures, one of them, the Earth one, is you can see this picture of the sun and everything. It's got these tendrils of kind of, you know, crazy stuff. And it just kind of looks like the moon looks like to us. It's kind of this soft curve edge, right? It's not a sharp, distinctive thing. It's kind of a softer thing. Whereas the moon, the moon eclipse was a much harder edge, and it's because of the relative distances and because Earth has an atmosphere.
Right.
And so you can actually see that Earth has an atmosphere by understanding what's going on here. You know, Earth is passing between our observatory and the sun, and the atmosphere is refracting the light from the sun and creating this soft edge, whereas the moon has pretty much no atmosphere.
Right. There are no sunsets on the moon.
There are no sunsets on that. Yeah. Wait, is that true?
Well,
there are no sunsets on the
moon. Well, the sun sets, but there's nothing special about it. It's just the sun, the orb goes behind the Earth. I mean, behind the planet. And on our planet...
No, there are sunsets on the moon. Once a month.
There's no atmosphere.
Oh.
No,
the sunset. Oh, I see. You're saying
I'm
like
saying
no
that sunset that we talk about are atmospheric conditional modifications based on sunlight going through.
And they're
it.
Nice and pretty.
And they're pretty and all that. On the moon, not so much. That's all.
I'd be pretty in a different way.
Suffocatingly so.
Okay, let's put it this way. You would never go to the moon to see an Earth-like sunset.
I might.
That doesn't make any sense.
It's not the primary.
Do we have any callers to save us from ourselves?
Yes, of course we do. From Salinas, Mark, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. You might look down to the earth and see the sunset through the thin layer of...
Yes, heaven. That's true.
I was wondering if you could explain how you can make something lighter than helium by using something heavier than helium.
Ah.
Yeah, so...
Does not make sense.
So it doesn't seem to make sense on the surface. What we were talking about, we were saying that in order to weigh this thing, you need to have it in a vacuum, right? So the only thing you're weighing, you're not weighing the air inside of it or anything like that. You're weighing just the material itself. So if you take a material like a sponge, but if you make it even more sponge-like, a lot more open space in it, but it still has some strength, it still has elasticity, it's still a physical thing that you can touch and you can, you know, mess around with, then because of all the open space, the heavier material that it's made out of, there's less of that heavier material.
It's
it's a density.
Let's put it
thing.
In a large scale thing. If you if you make a house, a wood house, like a traditional like wooden house, and you don't put anything else in it, you just make a wood house, the house itself is going to be less dense than wood, right? Because there's a whole bunch of space in it. Okay. And therefore it's not as dense if you think of it as an object. But the thing about this is that
about an average.
Yeah, well, that's actually what density is. But traditionally, when we talk about density, we take the object, we look at the material it's made, and we take a slice of it. But the actual physical material is structurally that airy. So it that is the molecule, if you will. It's the smallest of that stuff we can get, and it forms a structure. This is just like ice is, you know, less dense than water, even though ice is water, right? Because as it freezes, it makes crystallized structures that are. Bigger, if you will, than it's a water part liquid form.
Okay, so if you could make a bubble out of this material and the space inside was a vacuum, then you put it in a helium atmosphere, it would float.
Yes. Actually, if you put this stuff in a helium atmosphere, it would float.
Assuming that the helium
didn't penetrate it.
That's
assuming
the key.
The inside was a vacuum.
Right, assuming that, and that's the thing is we don't know if it's a porous sponge or a non-porous sponge.
I would
assume that its structure would get crushed by the gases if it was closed.
Actually, the whole point of materials like this is they want to use materials like this to sop up things like oil and oil spills and whatnot. Right. I mean, they can absorb something like 50 or 100 or somewhere
some
in that
amount
times their weight or times their mass, right? So if you have this really light material and then you run it through some material, it'll absorb a ton, just like a sponge would, right?
Yeah, cool. Thanks for the call.
If it absorbed helium, it would sink because the carbon.
Exactly.
That's right. In fact, it would probably get infused with helium and it would, you know, sink. Just like,
Yeah, you can't say, oh, if you put it in a helium atmosphere, it will float because that it won't actually happen because you can't look at that, you can't look at it out of context like that
if you somehow sealed the whole thing and didn't add weight to it.
Kind of comparing the...
If you took a cubic centimeter of helium inside of some kind of container and then you took a cubic centimeter of the stuff and you weighed them on a balance, then you would see that the helium is heavier. If you could do the experiment just right.
Mark, thank you for the call.
Yeah, I have another question about centrifugal force, but we should probably save that for another day.
Oh, no, you've wetted our whistle. Yeah.
Okay. The image in 2001 Space Odyssey with the astronaut jogging around the inside of the spinning space capsule, you know, as if it were simulating gravity.
Yes.
And certainly if you're laying against the inside sphere of a spinning cylinder, you're going to be held against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, you are in a very ultra-low gravity environment. So I'm asserting that if you were to step off of that surface, if you were to do as much as jog, which does mean that your feet leave the ground, you would float off into the middle of that thing, and eventually you'd run into the other side, but just because of your mass.
You wouldn't.
How can you be held to the surface?
Because your mass is going really fast. In fact, your legs cannot, in that circumstance, first off, Space Odyssey films are extremely realistic in their science fiction. They're really good at that.
Yeah.
But the idea behind that structure, and Babylon 5 is the same way, the idea is that you're spinning everything. The people that are on that surface are moving so quickly in one direction, and every time they touch the surface, they continue that movement, that they don't have the power in their legs to jump off that surface to change their velocity enough. They're going to run into it again. They're going to hit it again because they just simply can't overcome that the speed their body's going just like if you're running if you were thrown out of a car, you can't run fast enough, right? Like it's one of those kind of things.
So I don't know. I have a different explanation, I think, which at least works better for my brain, is centrifugal force is not really a force per se. It's more that if you spin something around at the end of a rope on over the top of your head, that thing at the end wants to go in a straight line.
Right.
Yeah.
And the rope around. Is constantly rope. Tugging it, right?
Right.
So if you're going, if you're standing on the inside of this, you know, gigantic thing that's rotating around, right? You're being pushed against the edge. If you jump, you're not jumping in a static reference frame.
Right.
Right. If you're in space and you jump, then of course you're just going to keep floating and floating and floating. But in reality, you are moving a little bit up, but you're also moving really fast in one lateral direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what I'm saying is it has to do with the relative force difference between the speed you're traveling and the jumping speed.
Yeah.
And the great way to think of it, the same context, same problem is if you're on a fifth story building and the elevator, you're in an elevator and the elevator cable breaks, theoretically, if you jump at the last minute at the very bottom, you won't die. But that's only if you can jump five stories, right?
It's only
because that's
jump
the
really
speed
fast.
Differential you're talking about.
Yeah,
and that's the issue is that you can't. So if you're in an environment like that in a space station that's orbiting, the closer to the center point you get, the less speed you're going to be traveling.
Right.
And therefore, you would at some point get to the point where you could detach from it, and it could spin around you, and you'd be floating. And that's totally
exactly.
true.
There's
and
a then, gradation here. What I'm saying.
And
is
then you could, but then in the center, if you got to that zero speed, you can then start traveling towards the outside. It's going to be moving so fast that when you hit it, it would be like jumping out of a car. That's the reason it's like the speed differentiation is really
depending on how fast it's spinning.
Well, that's the thing is if it's not spinning fast enough, you could be able to jump off of it.
Yeah,
right.
That's what I'm saying. If you can jump. If you can jog at all, if you can leave the ground with your feet, then you're no longer under the effects of that, except the fact that you will run into it again, sure.
So
it has nothing to do with whether your feet are touching the ground.
But here's the thing that Mark is saying that's really specific.
Uh-huh.
If the force is so great as to push you against the surface and you cannot jump, you would feel like you were more than 1G of weight.
Yeah.
If you're in a situation where you're 1G of weight, you should be able to jump off that and
But you'll land again.
Well, exactly. You'll land again.
So there's a very delicate balance point at which...
No, you wouldn't land again.
Yeah, you would land again.
If you can jump off, you'd eventually
float into the other surface and you would land there.
Yeah, no, it's a problem.
And the other thing I'm thinking is if you're standing on that surface and it's spinning around you, you're held to the ground, if you turn at right angles to the axis and you walk along the axis, you're going to feel like you're going to tip over. Because the momentum on your feet is faster than the momentum at your head.
I think a human would probably compensate for that. But I've been on an environment like that, and I think that's true.
Well, it also depends on how big it is. I mean, really, you're talking about your head experiencing a different force than your feet. But
that depends on how big the sphere.
Oh, if it were huge, But I'm thinking about the one in Space Odyssey. That was not that big.
I think, Mark, I'm gonna have to read up on some of the thoughts on this, and I think you're probably right.
I don't know. I just have this instinct. Sally Wright said I was wrong too, and I was.
We'll see. We'll see how the debate goes. Thank you, Mark. We'll move forward and find out.
Adios.
Bye.
It is a really interesting thing to try to contemplate because as humans, we never spend any time in zero G, and we certainly in microgravity.
Okay.
And we certainly don't spend any time in zero G spinning around in weird ways. So, like, how could we really understand it? You know, other than
have you ever been on America? Have you ever been on what are those things that
those horrible things that spin you around
that don't exist at parks anymore? There's one at Boomeria. Have you ever taken you to Boomeria?
No.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, Ben, I'm so sorry.
What's Boomeria?
I'll talk to you about it off air. Boomeria is awesome.
Where is it?
It's in Bonny Doon. It's a high school professor, Preston Q. Boomer, who has a wonderful castle and underground catacombs and all this stuff. Local people know all about it. But he's got one of those, and you can jump on it and spin it, right? And then if everybody's on it and they climb to the center, it starts going faster and faster.
Yeah.
Well,
rotational momentum, angular
momentum. Yeah. And if you're on the outside and it goes fast enough, you'll get flung off. But those things don't exist at parks anymore because they're so dangerous. But they do it at physics high school teachers' houses. So we'll have to go up there. But the point is that when you're actually on that and it's going fast enough so that you can't get off it, if you will, or move forward, it is very, it's very strong. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we'll talk about this more. From Santa Cruz, Bill, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there. I have a question about integrating semi-new hardware with fairly old hardware, in that I want to integrate or stream stuff off my iPad 2 onto my television.
No problem.
I have fairly old TV, and right now I use a Blu-ray player and the red and black and yellow wires to go from the Blu-ray into the TV.
Uh-huh.
And the Blu-ray only has a USB port, and I think it's got a LAN port, and it's and a mini HDMI.
Right.
Are the
oh, well, the mini HDMI. Is that mini HDMI in or out? Out, probably.
Out.
Yeah, you really can't loop this thing through your Blu-ray player. You're going to have to go directly to the TV. And you can get a cable that goes out of your iPad 2 and goes to what's called composite video.
And those are the cords you're talking about, the
yellow one.
The yellow one is the video. Yeah.
So, on the back of a TV, everybody's kind of familiar with the yellow, white, and red connector types. That's called an RCA connector because it was made by RCA Corporation and radio communication. I can't remember. And those three things, the red is the right channel of audio. The white is the left channel of audio. So it's just stereo. And the yellow one is video and it's composite. It doesn't have high resolution capabilities. So
yeah, it's very low resolution.
640 by 480.
No, it's much worse than that.
Really?
It's 240,
bad.
I think.
Yeah. No, it's not that.
It's 360 really? By 240 or something really low.
Anyway,
like
you're not going to...
It's an old TV. So
yeah, it's an old TV, so you're not going to... It doesn't matter anyway.
It's fuzzy. It's, yeah. And it's analog.
So you just unplug that yellow cable and then this connector that is from the... you can get it at the App Store. It's way too expensive. But they do work. The only thing is not all applications run on it to output video, and it depends on the operating system version you have of iOS. But yeah, I've used one quite a bit, and they're really kind of cool. You can just throw your iPad onto your TV, and presto bango, showing pictures. It's pretty awesome.
Okay. Another quick question, if you have a minute, is I use the iPad, you know, for doing work and email,
mm-hmm.
and then my email also comes up on my Outlook on my computer.
Yeah.
But I end up with email in two places.
Ah, okay.
Kind of a pain.
All right, so this is what you want to do. You want to switch to you're currently using a protocol called POP, and you want to switch to a protocol called IMAP.
Mm-hmm.
And so POP is Post Office Protocol, and IMAP is Internet,
Doesn't
mail,
matter, but POP is old, IMAP is newer.
Well, it basically means that your clients that connect to your mail server in IMAP actually get a copy of it, a cache, if you will, but they keep an update to what's going on. So if you delete it on your current mail, it'll delete on the server, but the marked red message actually happens. So you connect to both devices, and it doesn't matter where you read it. As you mark the message as red, both of them get updated. It's a syncing protocol. It's pretty awesome. I highly recommend using IMAP. So look into IMAP. You can find out the settings and all that. Just switch your accounts over to IMAP. The thing that's really important is that once you've downloaded through POP, it's not on the server anymore. So if you have the mail only on one device, that's the only copy you have. So be careful.
Well, exactly. That's what I find is it downloads it. So through Outlook, and it's a Yahoo account.
So do this for yourself. In all these places, you should be able to make a second account. Make a second account on like your Outlook application and make that second account, call it the same thing basically, but call it like number two, and then instead of setting up POP, set it up as IMAP, and you'll start seeing mail in there. Then move the mail in the client from the POP account to the IMAP account. That will actually put it back on the server through IMAP, and we do record the episode of Geek Speak, so you can listen back to what I just said again if you'd like in a few days. Thank you so much, Bill, for the call.
Most important, make a backup first.
Oh, backup.
Before
Everybody
you do anything that's scary, make a backup first.
Absolutely.
And if you don't have a backup, my gosh, make a backup right now
your hard drive's
going
to fail. Your hard drive's going to fail.
Yeah, it's not a matter of when of if. It's a matter
Please
of when.
Please have an automated backup process in place. It's more important than passwords. And I think passwords are important. Okay, let's move on. From Aptos, Bruce, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. You guys are pretty geeky today.
Thanks, I guess.
Maybe.
I've got a question about how to get certain parts of what's on the screen to larger size on real high resolution monitors and devices.
Okay, so like a Retina display, how do you show text that's larger or something?
Yeah, but what's happening when I change my different screen sizes or the number of pixels, uh-huh. I go to higher number of pixels,
mm-hmm.
things just shrink.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
when you're
changing, is there a way around that?
Well, it depends on where you are, but yes.
Yeah, so when you're changing, what you're talking about is display resolution. So if you change your display resolution, like my MacBook Pro right now is at 1680 by 1050, and you can get to that by going into System Preferences and clicking on Display. And if you change that to be lower, it's actually using all of the pixels of your device, but it's pretending that there are fewer pixels. And so things will be a little bit, some things will be nice and sharp, like text will be nice and sharp.
And it will be bigger.
Yeah, but everything might be a little bit blurrier. But if you're having trouble seeing things at your highest resolution, you're not going to notice the blurriness. You're just going to be able to breathe a sigh of relief and stop straining your eyes.
The question is, let's say you want all the resolution. You just want to make some of the text bigger, like the menu bar. You want to be bigger text because it's something I'm going to read a lot. But in general, you want to have high resolution.
And folders and things like that.
So if you're in a Mac book and you're using the built-in OS, you can go into View Options and change the Finder settings and fonts. So go into Finder and do View Options, and you'll see a whole bunch of choices there, and you can make that the default, and that'll all get bigger. And then you can also change some of the text. If you go into System Preferences, I think there's a...
Are you talking about accessibility?
Yeah, accessibility stuff.
Accessibility doesn't...
Accessibility works on some stuff, but it doesn't work on...
Exactly. Right. So that's the problem. If you don't go with display, display just takes everything and just makes it bigger. But if you want to keep all of your nice, pretty resolution and everything, but you want to make things generally bigger, you have to do it in every application that you want to do it in, right?
Now,
so if your web browser, all that stuff.
Now, there is a trick in almost all applications on a Mac. And that, I'm sorry, most applications that render text, all the web browsers do this. If you hold down the command key, which is the clover leaf, the Apple clover leaf, and the shift key at the same time, and you hit the plus symbol on your keyboard, you will actually increase the font. This will work in Firefox and Safari and Chrome. So that, to some degree, works. And then you can do the minus button as well.
That helps.
Sometimes
it's when I'm in Word, instead of having 100% to 150 or
right, 100%. Right. Yeah, that's just the way people end up doing it.
But it's still hard to see the lists of files and the folder names. And the toolbar itself.
Yeah, there's one more thing I would suggest that everybody should turn on because it's awesome. And Ben and I use it all the time.
Yep.
And this is a power user thing. And OS X, if you go into accessibility, and then you, on the left-hand side, there's going to be like Zoom.
Yeah,
okay.
Zoom.
And then one of the things you should have checked is, what is it called?
It's called Use Scroll Gesture with Modifier Keys to Zoom. I have it open. I'm not that crazy.
I open it too, I know.
What it lets you do is you can hold down the control key, and then you can do a two-finger scroll up or down, and it'll actually zoom in or out your screen. So that lets you keep everything nice and crisp and small and everything. But if you can't see a particular little thing, you can just zoom in on it by moving your mouse over there, holding down the control key
is awesome for doing screencasts or doing projections in front of an audience when you need to get to something. So if you enable this and you get used to it, using it whenever you need it, you just, zoom in whenever you want is really cool. And again, we're running out of time on GeekSpeak. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. We'll put the little note on GeekSpeak.org on how to do that, maybe in a screen capture or something. Oh, but we're running out of time today, so
we are.
We'll see how it goes.
Hey, did you hear Car Talk last week?
My wife has banned me from putting our triplets in this car.
I don't blame her.
So, I mean, I need to figure out something, Martha.
Get another car for the triplets.
That's the easy answer.
Come on, that's something we would have told her. Every problem may not have a solution,
but it's always worth a couple of laughs. Join us this week for Car Talk.
Car Talk's just ahead at 11 o'clock or the rebroadcast Sunday from 9 until 10 on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org, where we're supported by Burger, located in San Francisco.
This has been GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. We will be here next week, of course, as we are every week, and GeekSpeak is supported by... by Burger, located in Santa Cruz, and now in Aptos, featuring grass-fed, beef-free, range, turkey, or house-made veggie patties, over 50 craft beers on tap, and wine by the glass. Details at BurgerSantaCruz.com or BurgerAptos.com. See you next week. Thanks for listening to GeekSpeak.
We're 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. Just ahead, it's Car Talk with the Tappet Brothers. If you missed a portion of GeekSpeak this morning, or if you just need to review some important information or share it with a friend, you can go to our website and listen to GeekSpeak on demand or download the entire program on podcast. That's KUSP.org. KUSP is supported by the Arts Division at UC Santa Cruz, welcoming national and international composers and musicians to the month-long April in Santa Cruz Music Festival at the UCSC Music Center. More at arts.ucsc.edu. And by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Small Business Tech specializes in protecting data and has been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. www.radiotalk.com. Celebrating 40 years together, this is 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org.
Support for Car Talk on NPR comes from NPR member stations and
Tire Rack, whose tire and wheel specialists offer advice about tire.